Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Schrader, and I want to welcome you to our Faded Signals podcast from FadedSignals.com, where we talk about broadcast history. And I think it would be hard for you to find a radio station that had the kind of cultural impact that WSM in Nashville had. It essentially built the music industry in Nashville, Tennessee, made it Music City, USA, and it was instrumental in introducing country music to the nation, and really to the world. WSM started in 1925, the station of the National Life and Accident Insurance Company in Nashville. The call letters stood for the company's motto, "We Shield Millions." WSM later called itself the Air Castle of the South, and that's the title of Craig Havighurst's book, Air Castle of the South, WSM, and the Making of Music City. Havighurst is a Nashville-based writer, and about 10 years ago, he decided to start researching the history of WSM radio.
Well, I had started writing about music in Nashville, and to do that, one, you know, you've got to be fascinated with Nashville. It's a place that's been, it's contributed so much to the country's culture, but it's also so misunderstood and so easily parodied and caricatured that I found, you know, I moved here in 96 and I found a really inviting, special music culture. There's nothing like the songwriting community here. This large group of the best bluegrass musicians in the world lived here and worked here and played at the station in on weeknights. And you could just see just unbelievable stuff that was so much richer than what you heard on FM country radio at the time. I was fascinated by how the genre of country music had been so strangely distorted on country radio, and I didn't recognize most of what they were playing as country music, and I was really kind of ed up with questions about that from just a fan's point of view. I truly didn't know how it was possible that a genre could go so just kind of get off the rails artistically in a format with 2,000 radio stations, and indeed wound up as a reporter doing lots of work on stories that dealt with consulting, radio consolidation, things like that. But back in the late 90s, when I was trying to figure out Nashville and reading my big volume histories of country music to kind of get boned up as a fan and as a journalist, I figured there must be a book about WSM out there because it was clearly so central to Nashville's story. And I was really so shocked to discover that there wasn't one. So as a writer, that looked like an opportunity. And the more I looked into it, starting with the Country Music Hall of Fame's oral history collection and interviews with some of the business people who'd been there beyond the artists whose careers had been pretty well documented, I just found an unbelievable story of technology, culture, sweep of history, multiple musical genres, a huge world, well of pop music and gospel and classical music that had been presented on WSM live during the 20s, 30s, 40s that nobody knew about because everybody thought, well, it's been a country music station since the beginning, and that's all it ever did, but that was couldn't be further from the truth.
When we think about Nashville today and what it's become, when we go back to when WSM started in the 1920s, it was a completely different town.
Yeah, culturally so. No entertainment business, no inklings of one.
And the whole moniker of the Athens of the South.
They did have a sense of themselves as a high-minded place and an educated place, and a place where high culture should thrive. And I think they were a little defensive about people's ideas about the South and how that was a place where fine arts just weren't understood or couldn't possibly take root. And they knew they had the Ryman Auditorium where great symphonies had come through and great opera singers. And that in the Athens of the South expression, there was a wee bit of defensiveness or something.
When we look back to 1925, when WSM started, like so many of those early radio stations, it was an insurance company that started the station.
Yes, and I couldn't find an example of an insurance company that had started one earlier than that, though there were some examples later. At the time, they were looking at newspapers, department stores, churches, and a variety of other things. But I was looking for to see if anybody had any insurance coverage per se, sort of one. I couldn't find one. I can't say that there wasn't one.
In those early days on WSM, what was the programming like?
They wanted to be a real broad-based, super professional station that served the whole community, and that meant string quartet into a gospel group into a kind of light big band ensemble into the hillbilly music started pretty early, but pretty much only on Saturday nights on George Hayes' special little show that was the barn dance first and became the Grand Ole Opry. And it would be quite a few years into the 30s before they started to put what they called hillbilly music or folk music on the early mornings. But it was, you know, to listen to WSM and their routine broadcast day, you would not have heard what we now call country music. But it was, you know, a variety of sort of cultured music and light pop, that kind of thing.
I think it would be safe to say that what WSM eventually became really started with the ideas that George Hay brought. Who was George Hay?
George Hay had grown up as a newspaper journalist who'd worked in Indiana and Memphis, and he wound up in Chicago, kind of reluctantly recruited into radio, but radio was popping and there was demand for good writers, and he had created a character in one of his newspaper columns called the Solemn Old Judge, and that led to a role play on the radio, on-air character. But he was also a producer, so his role in the National Barn Dance out of Chicago in the early mid-20s, before WSM got on the air, was pretty important in shaping the way that show presented hillbilly music. And he had a bent for traditional folk music. He thought it was a noble reflection of the culture and not something to be looked down on. So he and Edwin Craig, the founder of WSM, the young man then at National Life and Accident Insurance Company, who made the case to the board to invest in this radio station and start it, they seem to have had a common opinion about folk music, hillbilly music, and they wanted it to be treated seriously. And Edwin had played some country music, old time music, with some friends in his boarding school years. So George Hay really genuinely loved that music. So his enthusiasm about it on the air was for real.
When the Opry started, how long did it take until it became that Nashville institution that we've come to know?
Well, I think for some people, very quickly. I think some people began to take great pride in it, and there were some debates that played out in the editorial pages of the newspaper in the 1927, 28, 29, mm-hmm. when you began to feel like some people began to complain that WSM, the national life station, their most important radio station, their reflection, national reflection to the whole eastern side of the United States, was beneath itself by letting these hillbillies on Saturday night. And some newspapers would solicit opinion and editorialize, and most of them said, look, this is a great program. It speaks to the whole state. We've got, working people are listening to this and loving it. The farming people are listening to it and loving it. And, keep it on the air. There was one little moment where it looked like they may, decide to cancel it, and it survived. And then really by the mid-late 30s, you began to have the stars really emerge who kind of gave it an anchor, the Delmore brothers and Pee Wee King and eventually Roy Acuff there in the early 40s. By the time you got to World War II, it was a powerhouse show, and then World War II really kicked it into turbo. I mean, the show's fans went all over the country and all over the world as part of the war effort and in the service, and spread the news and the enthusiasm about country music, and that accrued to the Opry's benefit. It was the training ground and the employer of every key person that planted a seed of the music industry in the 1940s and early 1950s when the city got going. The first publishers, music publishers, were WSM employees and alums. The first recording studio that was full-time that actually made records in Nashville was WSM Engineers Moonlighting, the first touring and booking agency, was the guy who had been booking the bands for the Grand Ole Opry. The first independent producers were Owen Bradley and Chet Atkins, who had their training at WSM. You take away WSM, there's just not that breeding ground for the what became an industry. We'd be all, Music City USA would be Atlanta or Dallas or Charlotte, North Carolina. But it was a concentrated effort by, over a couple of decades by people who got school, did it professionally, and then got entrepreneurial after that.
I know that NBC Radio picked up part of the Opry broadcast, and a huge part of its popularity around at least this part of the country in the southern United States is that WSM boosted its power to 50,000 watts. That must have been a big turning point.
50,000 watts thing came in 1932 when they built the iconic radio tower that is still in use today. And it was a big deal. They did vastly improve their coverage and began to bounce on what they called the sky wave across the West, and could be heard on winter nights, all virtually across the entire country and up in Canada. They had fans down in Cuba who wrote letters, and it was a big deal to be that large. And it was the chief engineer, Jack DeWitt, who spearheaded that and took care of the signal and keeping WSM on the cutting edge of broadcasting technically. And he was one of the characters that I was most fascinated with, because he'd grown up in Nashville, and he was so he was more from the blue blood side of Nashville. Didn't like country music. Was a fan of the Metropolitan Opera, and even had the opera piped into his house on a parallel signal to so he could listen to that for the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday.
As we think about that period in the 30s into the 40s when the Opry really is starting to take on national prominence, I think that we kind of assumed that all of WSM's programming was country music, and you said that it certainly didn't start out that way. When did we start seeing country creep into other day parts, if you will?
Well, from memory serves, I think we're talking about 1933, 34, 35.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very slow, gradual thing, and they began to realize they could reach the farmers as a major market for that music at 5:30 a.m. And then in the 40s, they added the Noontime Neighbors show, which was a mix of pop and country, but it was definitely serving the farming, rural Tennessee and rural South with John McDonald and the Dinner Bell kind of vibe. But they had a mixture of pop and country on that show in the middle of the day.
And I think a lot of people probably thinking about WSM, just thinking about radio in general, may not realize that during all that time, on through the 30s and 40s, WSM was still an NBC affiliate carrying all the old-time radio shows.
Yeah, they didn't. They ran, I think, less network programming than some, because WSM was actually providing the network with quite a lot of programming.
Mm-hmm.
They become the number one feed to NBC networks in the South, and they mixed and mingled, but by and large, the day was still full of live productions out of the WSM studios, and the NBC network connection was really huge for its prestige and its exposure, and they latched onto that in 1928 or 29. The radio station was still very young, and they were the first NBC affiliate in the South, and it was a big deal. Even more, I think, than the NBC carrying the Opry, is just WSM's relationship with NBC was so deep. And Edwin Craig, who did the lobbying that got it on NBC, also lobbied and got the Clear Channel status for the station, which gave them exclusive use of 6:50 a.m. across the country. And he got really involved in the National Association of Broadcasters. As an officer there, he was instrumental in founding BMI to get musicians, songwriters paid, and to restructure the way that radio stations paid for paid royalties for compositions. And it's truly amazing when you look into the depth of impact that Craig and his colleagues had on the national conversation about broadcasting.
As radio's golden age ended in the 40s on into the 50s, WSM expanded into FM and television. What were those early efforts like?
Jack DeWitt, who I mentioned before, was a real, you know, really an engineer at heart and a very pioneering one. And he wanted, as soon as he read about FM technology, he wanted WSM to be a part of it. So he rigged up an FM transmitter, quite a powerful one, and created a parallel station that went on the air in 1941 when nobody had FM receivers. And it broadcast all day long. Somebody's sitting there. They spun classical music, actually. They played classical music. And they were on the air for, I think it was about 8 or 9 years with absolutely no sales of ads whatsoever. It was a commercially just, you know, a non-viable. But they had the first FM, licensed FM signal in the country.
Wow.
And that struck me. And then they dropped it and then came back again when FM began to actually have a marketplace in the late, I guess, 60s. But and the television thing was really such a separate question because the TV signal was only going to serve Nashville. They had been a national presence for so long that the great debate in WSM was, well, on one hand, television's the future and it would be crazy for us not to be involved because we're cutting edge broadcasters. On the other hand, we won't reach outside the city limits. What are we going to do all day on this TV show? We have to create cooking shows and create, go to cover sporting events, and the technical challenges, logistical challenges were huge and a huge expense, and they weren't sure they could make money on it. And it was eventually successful. It became WSM-TV, which is now WSMV, the Channel 4 NBC affiliate in Nashville. And they were the first channel, and they had a 2-year monopoly because of some little deadline they'd beaten that the FCC put up. It was a technical wrinkle that gave them a real head start in many competitors. So they really established themselves, and they created some important newscaster personalities in Nashville because of it.
Through the 50s and 60s, and I guess on into the 70s, it seems that WSM AM, while it certainly offered its share of country music, it was also essentially a full-service station.
Absolutely, with an incredible investment in news gathering and news reporting. They for a long time, through the 60s, I'm sure, and in the 70s, had a 2-hour daily produced news report that covered the Middle Tennessee. I mean, it's incredible. It's sort of like NPR doing All Things Considered every night, but without the advantages of satellite phones and digital editing. I don't even know how they did it. They had a staff of 50, 60 people at one point. They won Peabody Awards. They were nationally known for the quality of their reporting, and they took it very seriously. And you need look only to that to know sort of how far radio has fallen in its sense of its own potential, its own dedication to its communities, to public service, to an ethos that says we matter and we're doing something. I mean, news on radio, with the exception of NPR and associated networks, is just a farce compared to that.
Ralph Emery, when did he come along?
Well, Ralph was the overnight jock, mid-50s, mm-hmm. Mid to late 50s. He had grown up in rural Tennessee and loved WSM all growing up and wanted to broadcast in school, and was looking for, you know, that kind of job. And he landed it when the overnight slot for a Opry Star Spotlight show came available, and nobody really wanted to stay up till 5:30 or 6 a.m. And he not only took that on as a young guy, you know, 20s, but he made the most of the show by turning it into a casual kind of hangout, where the artists would drop by after the Opry or after a Ernest Tubb Midnight Jamboree and just sit in the studio and chat and pick records and play a few songs and sit for hours at a time. And that ambience became a signature for him. And he was also developed into a really good interviewer. He just was able to draw stories out and do his stuff. So that kind of set the tone for people like Eddie Tubbs today, who do such a great job as curators of the story, you know. And Ralph Emery was kind of a journalist. And then he became the first star broadcaster on the national network, the cable channel that the company started, the national life, then as it became Gaylord, started in 1983, one of the pioneering cable channels. And there they were again, hitting a new medium really big with big investment and doing it very well.
You mentioned the Midnight Jamboree, and I do want to talk about that quickly because everyone thinks of the Opry, but there's another program after the Opry.
Yeah, and it's generated out of the Ernest Tubb Record Shop. And Ernest Tubb started the business when he was an ongoing star, but he was first concerned that fans were having trouble finding or ordering his records, and that Nashville was not, you know, it was doing a great job. Then it had recording studios, it had independent record labels, and it was producing the music, but it wasn't doing a very good job distributing it. So he became one of the first sort of actual record distributors, and mainly mail order. He had a retail shop in downtown, but it was the mail order business that did so well. And the Midnight Jamboree was just a promotion for the business and a late night party in the spirit of Golden Age Nashville. And it was very, you know, apparently just very loose and a lot of fun. And they still do it today, mm-hmm. Albeit in a more of a structured theater environment.
I listened to a WSM station sales composite, I think, from maybe 1973. And at that point, it's still very much a full-service kind of station. When did it switch to essentially 24/7 country?
Late 70s. I think 79 comes to mind as the date. And there was a long period where it didn't really quite know what they didn't quite to do with the AM station, where they had WSM FM, and it was also country. And it took a long time for WSM AM to find its identity as kind of a classic country station that played sort of, with mainly an oldies format. And then it went through a variety of dramas through the late 90s, 2000s, where they pushed the alternative country Americana genre pretty hard, and then backed off of it and went back to this sort of country gold format. And then, of course, had this internal debate, or more than a debate, with the corporation Gaylord, the new CEO, decided that WSMAM would be better as a talk sports station, like every one of its old clear channel full 50,000 watt brethren. And that news leaked out. I'm proud to say I broke that story at the Tennessean, and it sparked a real hue and cry, and a lot of country stars went personally to the CEO of Gaylord and said, you're new in town, we'll forgive you for making this dumb decision, but don't do it. It's not too late. And the whole thing got rethought, and when they had a big press conference at the Ryman where the CEO said, look, I was wrong, we're dedicating ourselves to country music and it's a national heritage, and off they went. And I still think that WSM struggles with identity. I think it's a little afraid to be too much of one thing and fully embrace the Americana side of country, where a lot of stuff that is in the tradition of country music is being made. But they've done such a great job serving bluegrass music. They keep the Opry has really tried to have a balanced approach to hits versus classics versus alternative country and bluegrass, and I think they do about as well as you could do.
They're very active online. What do you think the future's like for WSM?
Gaylord, its owner, has changed so much that it's hard for me to imagine that it, 5 years from now, it's still going to own the Opry, Ryman, WSM complex. But then again, I probably said that 5 years ago. And I don't see any big changes coming. And I know that periodically they are offered handsome sums to sell the whole entertainment business to another investor. I don't think that they would sell to a radio chain corporation like a Clear Channel or a Cumulus, because I think that they would look for an owner that was a caretaker of the legacy, because I think that everybody recognizes that without legacy, it's just an AM signal that would probably have to go, talk in order to drive the ad dollars and so forth. So, you know, no predictions. It's just Nashville's changed so much around it. And this music scene here is now so hip and so diverse, and yet country still remains important to it. You know, the latest being like Caitlin Rose, who's all over the national music blogs, has a lot of, you know, I would call her a country artist, you know, it's country music. You ask, where's a place for somebody like her? I don't know whether she's being spun on WSM or not, or whether she'd get on the Opry. It's not out of the question. But unless a new owner had that kind of sensibility to artists like that, and to sort of fit the new Nashville into its vision, they'd be walking on thin ice. I think that's where WSM has to be relevant.
It would seem so. Certainly, thinking about the demographics of who's listening to AM radio, for instance.
Oh, right, and it's a shame that AM, you know, AM does have this fidelity deficit. Although I tell you, it sounds really, really good on a proper tube receiver with a wooden cabinet. It's kind of amazing versus the 14 cents worth of hardware that is in every car stereo or every home theater. Nobody knows what AM sounds like because they don't ever get to hear it the way it was meant to be received. But that's another story.
Air Castle of the South is coming out in paperback.
Couldn't be more excited. It's been, 4.5 years since publication of the book, and we had a great run in the hardback. It's been on an academic press, so they have to be real cautious about what titles get to be in paperback, and I feel pretty honored that this made it through to that stage. And people have told me over the years that it's meant a lot to their conception of Nashville, their knowledge about how this city got to be what it is today. And I think we're watching Nashville mature to another level of artistic creativity and business intelligence, and be playing a part in the reinvention of the music industry, which is hugely important. And it's an amazing time to be here. There's just no question. But just culturally, it's very vibrant, and the artists who are moving here have that same fire in their belly and fascination with the possibilities that Nashville affords them that artists thought in the 1950s when they were coming, because WSM was sort of calling them here. So it's really cool to see it happen again.
You've been listening to Craig Havockhurst, who is the author of Air Castle of the South, WSM, and the Making of Music City. And one thing we really weren't able to get into in this interview are the big personalities, the larger-than-life characters who helped shape the early days at WSM, and thereby the history of Nashville's music industry. And he goes in depth in his book, and it really is a terrific read, especially if you're interested in the history of music, popular or country, the history of Nashville, and of course the history of broadcasting, because WSM's story is such a great one to tell, and he tells it very well. Air Castle of the South now is out in paperback at your neighborhood bookseller or on Amazon.com, and I have a link to the Amazon page where you can buy it directly on FadedSignals.com. Just enter WSM in the search box. By the way, Havockhurst also is the senior producer of Music City Roots, live from the Loveless Cafe in Nashville. And if you like Americana and roots music, this is a great program. It's online at MusicCityRoots.com. And it's also broadcast on a network of radio stations around the country. And you'll find a listing of those stations on their site. Again, that's MusicCityRoots.com. I want to thank Craig Havockhurst for his time talking about WSM. For more broadcast history, head over to FadedSignals.com. I'm Brian Schrader, and I thank you for listening.